Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Irish Economics Podcast. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Graham Brownlow to discuss the Northern Irish economy. So Northern Ireland hasn't got much focus so far in the series, so hopefully this episode will address this balance. Many of you will have heard our first episode with John Fitzgerald, where we discussed the economy of the Republic since the foundation of the state. Well, hopefully this will serve as a companion where we can go through the economics of the Northern Irish economy during a similar time frame. I learned a lot from this discussion. Growing up in Longford, we hear a lot about the politics of Northern Ireland, but not so much about the economy. Of course, politics has influenced the economy, and Graham takes us through that. But it's not always in ways that you would expect. One such example is the DeLorean car from Back to the Future, and how that ended up being built just outside Belfast. It's a fascinating story. All right. Okay, so hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Graham Brownlow, who's lecturer in economics at Queen's University Belfast. Graham has done a lot of work in the fields of economic history and business history with a particular focus on Northern Ireland. So it is with great pleasure that we have him on today to discuss the development of the Northern Irish economy. So, Graham, great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that in terms of the development of the Northern Irish economy, you would tend to frame it in the context of creative destruction and a number of long-run trends. Could you give us some insight maybe into what that entails?
Yeah, okay. So I think creative destruction, I think, is a pretty good way of framing long-run economic history, because it makes a lot of valuable points that we miss when we think about more short-run macro-type factors. So just to remind people, creative destruction, idea associated with Joseph Schumpeter, is the idea that economies are not in a state of equilibrium, that actually what economies consist of in capitalism is the creation of new sectors, new methods, new products that necessarily destroys old methods and old processes. And so when we observe regional development, rather than the idea in the 1960s, there was an idea that Northern Ireland had too many staples and that the problem in Northern Ireland was just the decline of staples. I think when we think about creative destruction, we recognise that it's not just the decline of old staples, which in many ways is inevitable, but it's also the failure to create new industries, new technologies, innovation, etc., that is needed to explain long-run development in general, and I think Northern Ireland in particular. So that's the creative destruction point, and it links into my general observation that in explaining Northern Irish long-run development, there are basically three factors. One are the factors that it shares with the long-run failures of the United Kingdom. So that's a long-run story that's not unique to Northern Ireland. The second point are there are actually a number of factors that are actually magnified versions of British problems. So actually what you see is a lot of problems that are long-run problems of the British economy are actually exist in Northern Ireland, but in magnified force in a magnified form. And last and not least, there are problems that are unique to Northern Ireland that a lot of non-economists would focus on. That takes us into areas of politics and such and so forth. So that's the way I frame it conceptually. I think creative destruction is a very useful insight.
Sure.
For thinking about regional development and Northern Ireland in particular. And the three-way split in terms of the long-run development. So those two things put together gave us a lot of insights that then we can think about the productivity problems that Northern Ireland has had over the long run. And I think that's probably the way I tend to frame a lot of my discussions in various papers when I think about Northern Ireland.
So as we're hoping to review the Northern Irish economy, perhaps it would be useful to start from what many people take as the beginning, the heyday of Northern Ireland as a centre for shipbuilding and other industrial activity. Perhaps you can take us through how Northern Ireland became established as a powerhouse in this regard and how a decline eventually came about.
Okay, so the story of linen and the story of shipbuilding and other industries within Belfast, like mineral waters and tobacco and rope, etc. I think if we start with linen. I mean, the story of linen is a story that goes back into the 18th century. And it's a story of initially rural Ulster, places in Armagh, and then the mechanisation of linen in the 19th century and the growth of Belfast are intertwined. So linen becomes, yes, it's provincial. You've linen towns like Lisburn and Lurgan, etc. But the primary driver is the mechanisation in Belfast. So that's the primary driver of linen in the 19th century. Shipbuilding is a more recent phenomena. It's very much 19th century onwards, primarily focused around Belfast, but there is some shipbuilding activity in other part in Derry, Londonderry, but it's mainly Belfast, and that's a 19th century phenomenon associated initially with the Belfast Harbour Commissioners. Belfast, the Lagan is not, unlike the Clyde, wasn't originally that well suited to shipbuilding, so it had to be Queen's Island, etc., was created, and so that was developed. Then you had Workman Clark and Harnell Wolff that were the two major shipyards. Harnell Wolff, the more famous one that survived the 1930s, the big yard, and ironically the wee yard, despite the fact it was maybe the fourth or fifth biggest yard in the world at its peak, Workman Clark. And these yards were, I think, at their peak employing Harnell Wolff, employing 25,000, I think, directly at its peak. And indirectly, many, many more. So you have these huge industrial footprints in Belfast of linen, and actually it's wider. I mean, it has shirt making up in Derry, for instance, handkerchiefs in Bangor, etc. But you have linen in Ulster that's widespread from the 18th century. And then you have, from the 19th century on, you have shipbuilding. That's very much a greater Belfast phenomena, urban phenomena, East Belfast phenomena.
Yeah.
And so these are, what explains these phenomena? Okay, so why textiles and shipbuilding? Well, essentially, linen draws initially on pools of cheap labour. So the story of linen was, originally it was household production was very much involved in the production of linen, and it's only really in the 1820s when linen becomes mechanized that there's a shift between the transaction costs and production costs of linen that makes it effective to make it into a factory firm-based activity. So actually linen was an early outsourcer, and my very first paper is actually about that.
Interesting.
But that changes in the 1820s. In the early 20s when the mechanisation comes in and technologically it becomes much easier to produce linen at scale in factories, and household production withers away and we move to mass textile production. The temperature and the climate and the rainfall of Ulster is important to the story of linen, because linen is a very heterogeneous product with different threads, and a damp climate rather like cotton, is helpful to handling these textiles. So it's not a coincidence that cotton develops in Lancashire, part of the world known for its rainfall, and linen develops in Ulster, part of the world also known for its rainfall. Yeah. That's not a coincidence.
Yeah, no.
Shipbuilding, on the other hand, develops also obviously in the pool of cheap labour as part of the story, but it also develops as part of the whole network of specialisation within different shipyards. So different shipyards very much develop different competencies in different types of ships. So Belfast, famously the Titanic, you know, ocean liners, was a big part of the shipbuilding industry. And part of the reason why employment was so high in Belfast was that that's a very labour-intensive form of shipbuilding.
Yeah.
Far more labour-intensive than bulk carriers, because, of course, you've got to fit out ocean liners with all the different people who aren't necessarily building the ship, but building the interiors of the ship. Mm. And that leads to lots of craftsmen earning large salaries as skilled workers, etc. So there's very much the story of shipbuilding after the 1930s is the story of one firm, Harnell Wolff. And before the 1930s, it's a story really of two firms. Story of linen, on the other hand, is a story of many, many firms. And those firms don't consolidate and are very politically interconnected with the Stormont government after 1920, and they're very involved before partition in unionist politics as well in the linen industry. Shipbuilding, on the other hand, of course, is very much an export, as linen also are export orientated, but shipbuilding policy is very much focused at the level of the GB government, because the resources required in terms of shipbuilding policy are way beyond the capacity of the Northern Irish government after 1920.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so you mentioned before, or I read one of your papers, you mentioned that there was a switch around maybe 1914 or thereabouts, where there was, is it a second industrial revolution, and Belfast didn't really take advantage of that to the same extent. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so this is the story again about creative destruction. Now, economic historians find the term Second Industrial Revolution is quite controversial, but I'll run with it. So the term Second Industrial Revolution is, as it suggests, it's the second wind of industrialization. And it's basically the period you could roughly suggest, roughly from about 1870 to the First World War, 1914, in which mass consumer products, electricity, etc., kicks in and industrializes, and new consumer products come in. Why this is important is in the Second Industrial Revolution, Ulster doesn't capitalize it on that phenomena nearly to the extent it did during the First Industrial Revolution of the 18th, early 19th century. And so again, it's a story about creative destruction. It's not so much that we have destruction, you know, the decline of staples. Well, the decline of staple industries is to be expected, you know, as we move into a world of alternatives to linen in the 20th century, and we move into a world of alternatives to shipbuilding in the 20th century, those declines are to be expected. The puzzle is, why not the creation of new industries in Northern Ireland that offsets our Ulster before partition, that offsets the decline of these industries? And we can speculate about some of those sources. But really, my primary concern in my writings has been post-1945. But I do think there's something very interesting happens in the economy of Ulster, and indeed Ireland, between, say, 1870 and 1914. Because, you know, when I was first taught Irish economic history, the observation was made that, you know, Ireland left the United Kingdom at the period of time it had done best out of being in the United Kingdom. So any sort of economic determinist arguments about Irish history are too simplistic. But there is something peculiar or odd about the fact, and I don't think it's a coincidence now, that we have these sort of home rule debates going on for 3-4 decades at the same time as, I think, the new second Dust Revolution. Possibilities are not taken up, but that's quite speculative. I haven't done really, really detailed research in that area, but I think there are enough smoking guns.
Okay.
No pun intended. Sure. to suggest that there is some relationship between that period of from the 1880s, particularly through to the 1910s, of that whole period of political agitation coinciding with problems in the competitiveness of business. And I think we can think about why that might be, given the links between the business community and the political elite in Ulster.
Okay, so the political sort of aspects may have held back.
Yeah, I think actually, I mean, I wrote about this a long time ago in sort of 2006-07, long before Brexit. But I think Brexit kind of germinated in my mind the issue that actually businesses have limited time. Okay, so, you know, introductory economics, the opportunity cost of time.
Mm.
And so businesses really, boards of directors, etc., want to be thinking about innovation, cost reduction, those sorts of things. But when you have a period, certainly within unionist politics, from the 1880s through to the 1910s, where a lot of the leadership of unionist resistance to home rule were actually major figures within business, that's time not been spent developing new products.
Sure.
That's time not been spent in innovating. This also coincides with the whole British phenomena of what's called the entrepreneurial failure debate. There's a big discussion about what goes wrong in entrepreneurship within the UK in this period. So I think you could tell, and again, I'm speculating because I haven't really done serious research in this area, but I do think one could hypothesize that the time that was being spent on political agitation can't have been helpful to businesses in developing new goods and services if they were spending their time basically meddling in politics. That's the first observation. The second observation is by the time we get through to 1945, then I think that an established link between politics and business has been created. And I'm not sure that that has been all to the good for Northern Ireland since 1945 to the present day.
Okay. So moving on to maybe your area where you have done a bit more work on, like 1945 onwards, and industrial policy during this period. One thing you've discussed was rent seeking. Could you maybe tell us how this plays out?
Okay, so just a reminder for those who maybe haven't studied rent seeking, or a revision for those who have. So we tend to think in introductory economics about profits and efficiency. And we know from, you know, Econ 101 that monopoly is associated with, you know, higher prices, lost output. So there's a welfare loss, often called the Harberger triangle, after the economist who first sort of did measurement in this area. But that's not the whole story about monopoly and why it's damaging to an economy. Because the observation was made that actually, yes, monopolists get a monopoly rent, okay, and that's why they want to be monopolists. And monopolists being rational human beings, they want to invest resources to secure that rent. And the question is, how much are they willing to spend in terms of securing that rent? Well, up to the value of that rent. So rent seeking essentially is how much in terms of resources in an economy, are you going to invest in trying to secure these special privileges? And of course, by securing those special privileges, A, you've incurred those resources in terms of securing the monopoly, and combine that with the welfare losses makes monopoly look a lot less efficient than if you simply looked at the classic Harberger triangle type story. So that's the sort of conceptual point. Now, it ties in with rent-seeking because What then happens is the argument goes about when you design public policy, if you design public policy of a set of subsidies, then it's very much in the interests of businesses to lobby for those subsidies, because those subsidies are essentially tax-free.
Yeah.
And so they're actually very lucrative. Whereas if you go for government purchases, well, you might get revenue, but you still get taxed on that revenue. So actually, you know, and this is a point, goes back to George Stigler, in a wonderful one-page note in the Journal of Political Economy back in 1966. Stigler made the observation that actually it's in the area of subsidies and tax privileges that we should be most concerned about type of rent-seeking behaviour, although he didn't use the term, rather than government purchases. And that feeds very much into, you know, rent-seeking is observed around the world, and Anne Kruger very much developed the whole literature in sort of developing countries. But we shouldn't get away from the fact that rent-seeking can exist in developed economies, and while nowhere near the scale that you see in developing countries, it still can be pretty profound in its cumulative impacts within developed countries.
How did the rent-seeking then manifest in the Northern Irish economy during this period?
Okay, so within Northern Ireland, cutting a very long, tedious story short, you essentially had a situation where after Northern Ireland's created, responsibilities were divided up between the British government and the Northern Irish government. And from about 1920 through to 45, yes, there were examples of what we would now call rent-seeking, but they were restrained by the budget issue, the fact that the levels of resources sent to the Northern Irish government from Whitehall were comparatively small. But there was definite examples. David Jordan, my PhD student who's just completed, has observed, you know, evidence of all sorts of problems in people applying for subsidies or licenses and being confronted by the fact that the people who are granting the licenses or subsidies are already incumbents within an industry.
Yeah.
This obviously creates a problem which acts as a huge entry barrier. So again, taking us back to the story about the Second Industrial Revolution, I think a lot of the problems before 1945 is a problem about not so much destruction, but creation. But what happens after 1945 is, and particularly after 1958 and 1963, is the scale of industrial policy intervention in Northern Ireland massively increases. So if you want to think of it this way, the size of the possible rents is increasing. This is a problem. This would not be a problem in and of itself. Mm. You know, you can have industrial policy that works elsewhere in the world very successfully and limit rent seeking. I mean, there are examples we can discuss. But in the Northern Irish context, this was complicated by the fact, and contemporaries knew this, but I think took an erroneous interpretation of it, that what Northern Ireland was unusual about was the ease of access to policymakers. At the time, people like very eminent economists like Charles Carter or Lawrence in Standard Politics text from the 1960s, and indeed The Economist in its special issue from, I think, 1955, all discussed the ease of access of policy makers and business leaders in Northern Ireland. And at the time, the consensus was that the ease of access was such as to help business in Northern Ireland thrive relative to GB. Charles Carter famously talked about the tiresome complexities that you faced within GB were avoided in Northern Ireland. The tiresome complexity of getting things done, he said, to a land where enterprise is made officially welcome. So at the time, people were well aware of this access. But if we look more closely, and this is where the archival digging comes in, and going back to Hansard and newspapers and all, we observe that Northern Ireland didn't have the same conflict of interest regulations as the rest of the United Kingdom. also we observe that its grants subsidy system was much more generous than in GB. And if we compare it to Scotland, which I've done elsewhere, if you look compared to Scotland, Scotland essentially after 1945 had far less generous subsidies. They were generally loans, not grants. And monies were spent on public housing. And there weren't what's called advance or free factories. Northern Ireland didn't spend on public housing, which, as we were to find out in the 1960s, was problematic, put it mildly. And they'd have free factories. Now, this is a situation that goes on till 1963. That what happens is that essentially business leaders who are well-connected often were politicians. So if you think of the Venn diagram of business elite and political elite, you have a massive overlap of the business elite and political elite. And you also have the fact that people can award themselves free factories or friends or family or whatever. And I'm afraid the evidence does suggest that went on. So far from ease of access in Northern Ireland being a competitive advantage for Northern Ireland, I think that when we go back to, say, Nick Craft's work, where he showed that there was an underperformance of growth in Northern Ireland, I think it's more compatible with a story that suggests that actually this awarding of resources was associated with politically well access businesses getting grants and subsidies rather than the best possible enterprises. So I think there was a gap or a wedge between what the society's interest and what was in private interest. And I think that the evidence for this is also reinforced because, as I've shown, when the regulations are changed in 1963, there's a transformation in the businesses that receive the subsidies. They become bigger, they're more efficient, they have lower costs, they're higher productivity, and go through the list of all the different virtues they have, and performance improves. And Northern Ireland actually grows faster than GB from 63 to 68. Female employment massively grows, because one disadvantage of this rent-seeking system is it reinforces monopsony in linen. You know, linen was for a long time the major employer of females. And when the linen lobby saw that possible new industries would come in that would look to hire female labour, obviously that could bid wages up. And there was large-scale political opposition to that happening. I mean, and this isn't unique in Northern Ireland. I mean, you know, there are industrial towns in the north of England I could talk about where this sort of issue arose. But these new industries emerge and drive up the female employment in Northern Ireland. I mean, so under Terence O'Neill, despite the fact that textile employment drops, the actual total employment of women massively increases in Northern Ireland. So there's a lot of issues where I think that sort of the Nick Crafts, who in his original paper only surmised that rent seeking might have existed, I think that the evidence I showed in that 2007 paper tends to corroborate that interpretation.
I can think of a lot of examples of where there are business people who did well in politics, and it seems one would complement the other. I wonder, the fact that Northern Ireland is perhaps a bit smaller, people might know each other a bit better, would that have had a factor to play in it?
Yeah, well, I think that a lack of serious electoral competition is a big issue. And the fact that you had for the 1950s, you know, the so-called New Industries Acts, or capital grants, and one of the most bizarre smoking guns is the fact that in the 1950s, half of all the money that was supposed to go to re-equipment for new industries, half of the money was going to the linen industry. Now, by the 1950s, that's 130 years after really the establishment of linen in Belfast. Even on the most generous interpretation, I don't think 130 years it can be associated to be new.
Yeah.
So when you look at it that way, I do think they're just connections, and I do think they're family connections and overlaps. In other words, what I'm suggesting, and I wrote my paper long before the renewable heat incentive scheme, the RHI scheme and scandal, I think a lot of the behaviours one observes in that RHI, the Coughlin Inquiry report that just came out earlier this year, a few weeks ago, we're not in uncharted territory. Those behaviours did exist long before and had to be restrained. I think size is part of it. People wear multiple hats. Size is also part of it because there's such a proximity and closeness of people. And size is also part of it because the people who could be whistleblowers are, you know, ignored. So I think there's issues. So electoral competition and size, I think, are probably issues. And the issues of competition and the issues of efficiency, all the things that Iles and Cuthbert in the first government commission report, the so-called Economic Survey of Northern Ireland, it came out in 1957. I mean, the story of that paper was interesting because that sat on the shelf for 2 years.
Right.
Because they identified problems in competition in Northern Irish economy. And it's interesting when you go back to the archive that actually there was a spin operation. There's a 22-page document that was given to, I think, all unionist MPs that was to disassociate itself from the report that the Northern Irish government itself had commissioned in 1948. So, you know, I mean, going through it all, I think that there's enough evidence, I think, to point in the direction that I do think that politics and size and the dominance of certain groups, I do think does suggest that it did damage the Northern Irish economy. Now, I don't believe it's the only thing by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think if you want to explain the gap between Northern Ireland and GB, you need to think about what differs between Northern Ireland and GB. And this phenomena is clearly a phenomena that does differ from Northern Ireland and GB. And, you know, I think actually if one was to look closer at the South, I think one would find quite similar behaviours in sometimes in the South.
Yeah.
I think unfortunately just a lot of these research just hasn't happened in the South.
Sure.
But so I don't think Northern Ireland's unique, and I don't think it's particular political philosophies. But it's interesting that your contemporaries were well aware of how important access was. I mean, like I said, The Economist talks about an awful lot of it in its entire special issue back in the 50s.
Right.
But at the time, people thought it was a good thing. I think we now see that it's actually was a far more mixed thing.
So you mentioned Terence O'Neill there, Prime Minister of Northern Ireland in the 1960s. It seems that if ever there was a time for Northern Ireland to move towards a more outward-looking economy, it was under his stewardship. I understand he had meetings with Sean Lamass and Whitaker, who are widely cited as the architects of opening the economy of the Irish Republic and setting the seeds for positive economic development. Was there ever a prospect of this happening under O'Neill's leadership in the North?
Well, the causality, well, first thing is Ken Whitaker and Terence O'Neill were great friends.
Right, okay.
But the other thing, actually, historically, it was actually the South imitating the North.
Okay, right.
There's a 1950s paper by Charles Carter in Studies in which he talks about the Northern Irish commitment to foreign direct investment and talking about how much more liberal Northern Ireland was than the South at the stage. And, of course, until well into the 1990s, Northern Ireland per head was consistently higher than the South. So, actually, if you look at the literature, it was what could the South learn from the North?
Right.
Again, you go back to the papers of the time, it's what can the South learn from the North? I mean, what differs, of course, is that the South was a national government. With all sorts of power over tax levers. for example, an education policy that the North just didn't have. But actually, I think my reading of it is actually that the North was more an inspiration to the South than vice versa. If the North had an inspiration, it was the general intellectual move of planning of GB, you know, the national plan of the Labour government of 64, and even further back, there's the growth pool literature that's risen up. There's also a number of economists like Charles Carter, I've mentioned before, who are very influential on Ken Whittaker. Loudon Ryan, Professor Trinity, who's from Portadown, again, massively influential on Whittaker. And a lot of these, when you look closely, you see that that there is a technocratic atmosphere. People like Tom Wilson, I would say, who's a professor at Glasgow, but was originally from Belfast. And he's very good friends with a lot of the establishment in Belfast and London. And he becomes a very important figure when the Troubles erupt. There's a lot of modernisation thinking going on within within the North and within the South. But I actually think if you were stand back dispassionately, it's actually Whittaker is a great synthesizer of other people's ideas. There's no doubt that I think Charles Carter, if you look at the paper and studies, what we associate with economic development is actually far more Charles Carter's paper than actually economic development's text.
Economic development, of course, being the title for Whittaker's paper that many cite as being the blueprint for the modern open economy of the Irish Republic.
Yeah, I mean, there's an old line in economics that a classic is much cited and little read. And I think Whittaker's economic development is a classic of that genre.
Right.
Because actually, if you look at it, it's actually primarily about agriculture. It's a very small state document. It talks about the affordability of welfare states. It isn't really an industrial export-orientated paper whatsoever. Whereas if you look at Carter's article, it's all about foreign direct investment and supply side, technological and managerial advantages. So I think that what we come to know as sort of the post-60s Southern supply side revolution of Lamass and Whittaker, in many ways, is actually more the fact that it's a consistent implementation of ideas of people like Loudon Ryan, Charles Carter, etc.
Right.
In no way would I detract from Whittaker's work in the area of Northern Irish politics. I think that in future historians, I think, will increasingly come to recognise how important he was in having sanity within policy circles about Northern Ireland. But I think that actually, if you look closely, he wasn't really an original economic thinker. He's a great synthesizer. But I think that it's actually the North that actually led the South for a long time.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the North had higher income per head well into the 1990s. You know, it wasn't like the Northern Ireland was a basket case.
Sure.
You know, if we were to go and look at if we looked at Irish nationalist economic literature, that wouldn't be the interpretation at the time. Indeed, there's a lot of rewriting of history that's gone on for understandable reasons.
So around the 60s then, 70s, there would have been some industry, but this would have been a period of decline, I presume.
Yeah. So one of the complexities and tractabilities of trying to think about the impact of the Troubles in Northern Irish economy is the counterfactual is very complicated.
Yeah.
Because even if the Troubles had not have occurred, let's imagine that, that's an incredibly complicated counterfactual to begin with. Even if that had not happened, we still would have had the oil shocks and deindustrialization and all those other processes that began. That began in the 50s and 60s. You know, I think I'm right. From memory, I think the peak share of manufacturing employment in GB was about 1955. the peak share for most developed economies, however, was much later, so about 1973, 74, Canada, Italy, etc. If I look at Northern Ireland, from memory, I think the figure is 1962. So, you know, deindustrialization kicks in very early on, and then it's magnified by a lot of geopolitical as well as economic shocks. I mean, deindustrialization is a fact of life, even if the Troubles hadn't happened.
Yeah.
Those facts of life would have kicked in. So there's never a good time to have something like the Troubles, of course. But, you know, economically, you know, it's the worst possible, you know, perfect storm. That part of the story of the Troubles and the way the Troubles shape the economy and vice versa is that it interacts with the Troubles in a way. That makes it incredibly complicated. I mean, again, the archival work I've done, when you're reading through the policymakers' notes, I mean, a lot of they're incredibly sophisticated in their thinking. And it's incredibly difficult what they're trying to do, because they're trying to deal with the deindustrialization of the north of England, Scotland, and all those other places that is going on at the same time dealing with this very complicated political situation with all the issues about resource allocation that are tied in with it. So, there's a lot of complexity. And I'm not sure. I don't think we can disentangle to a single number.
Sure.
There are a number of studies that try to do that. I'm very skeptical of that. I mean, I've done literature reviews of the literature on the Troubles, and there are things we can certainly say the Troubles did to the Northern Irish economy, but I think it would be wrong to turn around and have a single number.
Yeah. So would a lot of industry leading into this period would have had been sustained by subsidies? You might have had a lot of heavily subsidized industry, and then that's only there, you know, it's on life support, essentially.
Yeah. So, I mean, one way to think about it is that there's a higher level of subsidy in Northern Ireland consistently from 1945. And actually, one of the fascinating issues about the early years of the Troubles is how both unionists and nationalists lobby to ensure that the gap, what's actually at the time called the inducement gap, between subsidy in Northern Ireland relative to GB is preserved.
Right.
So you have these what now look like unholy alliances of all the political class of Northern Ireland clamouring to ensure the inducement gap is preserved. That's the first observation. The second observation, of course, is how inducement gaps are required as a sort of risk premium. You can think of it that way. And more particularly after what's called the Cairn Cross report in 1971, there's an explicit recognition of what we'd call an economic circular causation problem, but, you know, more generally a vicious circle problem. Cairn Cross in 1971 is called in notionally by the Northern Irish government, but actually it was the Treasury that decided it should be Cairn Cross. Cairn Cross had to investigate the fact that the various development plans in Northern Ireland were all off target.
Nice.
Now, what happens again in Whitehall is the Treasury are very slow in the uptake because of what's called the Barber boom and things like that. They're going on at the level of the UK economy. The Northern Irish economy continues to grow through 69, 70, early 71. Then very quickly after the introduction of internment and violence, it spikes up. Then everything goes haywire. But in Whitehall, a lot of Treasury officials are very sceptical about the messages coming out from the Northern Irish government, because they're just looking at the data that shows output continuing to grow, blah, blah, blah. They're missing the point that the situation has changed very quickly. So Cairn Cross is brought in, and he creates, I think, a very important document, the Cairn Cross report, in which he just says, well, you've got a cumulative causation problem here, that essentially unemployment is a recruiting sergeant for paramilitaries. And violence, of course, creates unemployment through destroying investment. So what you have is a situation where violence destroys investment. Okay, investment then falls, unemployment goes up. Unemployment goes up, which acts as a recruiting surge for paramilitaries.
Right.
Violence goes up.
So this feedback loop.
Yeah, so he then identifies in that 71 document that it isn't a question of stabilizing the economy versus stabilizing society. That's not the argument. He actually turns around and says, what you actually need to do is you need to short circuit this collapse. And Kern Cross, of course, one of the reasons why he was selected for this report is he had worked for the economic section during the Second World War. The economic section were a group of economists who were involved in wartime planning. People like Lionel Robbins, etc., are associated with it. Tom Wilson, who I've mentioned before. These guys were all involved. And so what Kern Cross said is you needed to create a way to short-circuit this vicious circle, this feedback loop. So he said what you need to do is stop investment collapsing. So he said you needed to create what he called the Northern Ireland Finance Corporation, what becomes the Northern Ireland Finance Corporation. And it basically throws money, £50 million is the original budget, into manufacturing in Northern Ireland to stabilise production and investment with a hope that unemployment doesn't rise too far and hence the political situation can be stabilised.
Okay.
And that's very much the philosophy that underpins a lot of the British government's behaviour in Northern Ireland right up through the 1990s.
Okay.
Indeed, the document I've seen as late as mid-90s, they're still using this term interrelated strategy, in which they're saying that moving progress in Northern Ireland is going to require a mixture of economic, strategic and political advantages. Now, why as an economist that's important is there's a recognition of trade-offs between those three objectives. And so when we look at Northern Ireland's failure to close the productivity gap, I mean, there's some economists like David Fielding in their work on the Troubles have turned around and said that the failure to close the productivity gap during the Troubles is an indicator of public policy failure. I think this is a strange interpretation of the evidence, and it shows why archival evidence is important. Because once you recognise that there are actually three objectives, or three sets of objectives, I should say, the political, the military, and the economic, and you're willing to trade off between them, that actually they were willing to trade off productivity gains.
Yeah.
Very obviously, because creative destruction, you know, creative destruction is a good thing.
Yeah.
But ordinarily, but if creative destruction means outmoded forms of production are replaced, you need new industries to emerge. But if the political situation is deterring foreign direct investment, tourism, etc., new industries are not necessarily emerging.
Yeah.
So you're very clearly, you want to focus on levels of employment rather than productivity. The good news is you stabilise employment. You hold Northern Ireland together.
Mm.
You stabilise employment levels, reduce unemployment levels as far as you can. That's good news as far as it goes. But of course, it means you don't tackle productivity. You don't tackle the underlying supply side problems of the economy.
Yeah.
And it also means that when you're trying to attract FDI, there are two problems. One is the quantity of FDI you can attract is reduced. More importantly, perhaps, which takes us into the whole story of DeLorean, etc., is that people that are willing to come in may be opportunistic or of low quality. So I think that when we're talking about, say, the story of DeLorean, doesn't really begin in 1978 or whatever people conventionally say. It actually begins in 1971 with Kern Cross, because Kern Cross lights the touch paper of the Northern Ireland Finance Corporation that becomes, it's relabeled the Northern Ireland Industrial Development Authority, I think, in 1973-74. It's then wound up, becomes the Industrial Development Board, the Northern Ireland Industrial Development Board, And then that becomes later on the Industrial Development Board for Northern Ireland that now is InvestNI. So the whole Rock family tree, if you like, think of it that way, of inward investment in Northern Ireland today, InvestNI is traceable back to the Northern Ireland Finance Corporation in 71, arguably.
Okay, so that makes a lot more sense when it comes to interpreting the story of DeLorean in Northern Ireland. So perhaps we can set the scene here for those who may be unfamiliar. The DeLorean car that featured in Back to the Future was actually built outside of Belfast in Dunmurry, I believe. So John DeLorean was a businessman who cut his teeth in Detroit with General Motors and wanted to set up a sports car company. And he ended up in Northern Ireland, where he got the most favourable deal in terms of public supports. But the background that you provided there is very enlightening, because when you hear the story, you wonder why were these subsidies offered. But it's now clear to me that there was a strong political motivation to keep employment rates high, and the political value was so high that it justified extremely high subsidies.
When we think about the DeLorean story, I mean, there's lots of angles I could go up. But I think if you've been charitable, there's what's called in development economics flying swan argument, or a vanguard argument. And the argument of a flying swan or the vanguard type argument is that a few key high-performing in foreign direct investment projects act as a template or exemplars that other people follow. So in other words, the idea in development economics of flying swan type arguments in contemporary literature is you might want to put a large sum of money behind a project because that project is so influential that everybody follows after it. And that's a charitable way to think about the DeLorean project. I think there's a story about the DeLorean project about going into the minutiae of Stormont and Whitehall, where different interest groups within Whitehall had different agendas. The Treasury had long been sceptical about Northern Ireland. I mean, there's very sardonic papers about Northern Ireland going way back, at least the 1950s, probably actually earlier, but certainly from the 1950s, there's lots of very sardonic. There's one note by the great Leo Palatsky, a really exceptional Treasury economist. He said something along the lines of, we have to support democracy in Northern Ireland, or what passes for democracy in Northern Ireland. So there's this real cynicism in the Treasury about Northern Ireland very, very early on. And that's also traceable in the DeLorean story, where they're very sceptical about the wisdom of it. Then you have the Northern Ireland Civil Service and the Northern Ireland Office, London, and they're very, very much taken by the idea of DeLorean. So the civil servants are very much the drivers of the story. Again, no pun intended. So there are three possible public sector locations. The first was Puerto Rico. The second was the IDA, actually in Limerick. The Northern Ireland. It'd be late 70s, so it'd be about 77, 78. Now, the story about why he doesn't go to IDA is they offer a much lower set of subsidies. That's the first thing. I mean, the second thing is that the IDA, as you know, is arm's length from the Irish government. In a way, InvestNI is supposed to be today. Point was that DeLorean very, very vociferously was lobbying the IDA in a way that raised the hackles of the IDA, and that led to people calling a halt on any negotiations. But I don't think even if they'd called a halt in negotiations that it would have ever gone down south, because the scale of subsidy was much lower. Puerto Rico and Northern Ireland were the two front runners, and indeed Puerto Rico thought it had it in the bag until the very late in the day. I'm not sure that there's a convincing story exactly about the Northern Irish, how Northern Ireland came into the game.
Right.
There are a variety of different versions of the story. So rather than indulge in myth-making, I think the important thing to note is it's roughly 40 days from original introduction to a memorandum, essentially a contract, been drawn up. So it's very, very rapid. And again, the scale of the subsidy offered by Northern Ireland is a multiple of what's been offered by either Puerto Rico or the IDA. So the scale of subsidy is there. The factory gets set up. There's a whole bunch of delays. There's also bad luck in terms of a cold winter, etc. But none of these stories should take away from the fact that the firm is very much undercapitalized in a lot of ways, because, you know, DeLorean had been trying from about 74 to 78 to get private sector investment, and he conspicuously failed. And it was really at that point that he transferred thinking about public sector funding.
Right.
So the story about DeLorean then, again, like going through all the nuances, going back to the Flying Swan sort of argument, increasingly it becomes the case that DeLorean is hemorrhaging cash, and the Treasury is increasingly saying this is silly, and we've had a whole series of problems with the contract under which DeLorean is established. And rather than it acting as a vanguard to attract further investment in Northern Ireland, it's actually acting as a disincentive.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
To come to Northern Ireland, and I think when that kicks in, goes too far, then the money is pulled out, and then the project collapses. But I think we shouldn't get away from the fact that there's a whole series of incentive problems. I mean, I've written about how when you observe the actual employment levels in DeLorean, they are massively underperforming their target until very late in the day, and then they go shoot over the target. And why is this? Well, why this is, I argue, is, again, by going through all the details of all the contracts, essentially there's a provision in the contract if DeLorean does not reach his employment target after, I think, 5 years, then he has to basically pay back a bunch of money, which he's not inclined to do, obviously, and they probably not able to do. So that's the first thing. The second thing, of course, is I I believe, although you can't see it black and white in the sources, but I think there's enough there to make the inference that he's been very cunning. And what Delorean really realised was that, yes, the demand for the car was not there, but the more jobs he created, the bigger the headache he was creating to close the factory, if you understand. And so he basically, I think his calculation was, A, by massively hiring too many people, going on a hiring binge, firstly, it means I hit my target prematurely for employment, so I'm never liable to pay back monies, because it's all about employment.
Yeah.
And secondly, politically, and probably more importantly, the bigger employment levels I got hired at Delorean, the harder it is to shut the gates. And I think the Treasury were very aware of that. I mean, there's examples of documentation that are in the files where DeLorean is going round late in the day, starting to blame the troubles for what's going on in the business. Now, again, cutting a long story short, there's not a lot to those arguments. But the problem is, of course, if DeLorean is going into the American media saying the political situation means his business can't succeed, then that acts as a deterrent for other investors coming to Northern Ireland. So far from him being a vanguard or flying swan to attract further investment, he becomes a disincentive.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing is that the business cannot keep becoming a bottomless pit of cash. You know, so, you know, DeLorean, there's like 20 odd million extra in a variety of guises that the Thatcher government ploughs in after it comes to power in 1979. You know, so a lot of what I would call conspiracy theorists who've written about DeLorean say that the problem was simply Thatcher couldn't stand industrial policy and wanted to close the factory when she came in. Well, you know, she gave it 20 odd million quid, higher slice the number, you know. So I don't think it's that. I think actually what happens is the Treasury are empowered, and eventually the Treasury say to the Northern Irish officials, you've had your fun, but you get a better close the gates.
But it's really, it all comes together when you give it a historical perspective that there is this interrelationship between economy and the politics. So there is this political motivation to keep employment high, and that's what motivated this contract that led to a business plan that was not really sustainable, and the fact, and also coupled with somebody who wasn't really putting together a good business plan in the first place, and then once you're in, it's very hard to pull out.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's like, you know, when you go back to contemporary documents in the 1950s, you see civil servants talk about the linen lobby.
Yeah.
You know, when you go back to the late 1970s, you see Treasury documents talking about DeLorean, talking about sunk costs. And there's a massive awareness at the Treasury that this type of factory is going to be sunk cost. It's you know, if it goes out of business, you're not going to get another car firm.
Yeah.
in that factory, you know, and as things turned out, yes, it was massively sunk cost. So it wasn't simply the level of the resources that went in. You know, the official figures I think was it £83 million. That's the official figures. But the £83 million doesn't include, for instance, all the money that the UK government paid to McKinsey's to monitor DeLorean.
Right.
For a start. And more importantly, the £83 million doesn't include the opportunity cost. The cost per worker at DeLorean, it is huge. It's very, very high.
Yeah.
If you wanted to create the maximum number of jobs in West Belfast, you would have been far better in putting that money into house building. Public house building, A, would have created the direct employment benefits of the people involved in construction in housing. And secondly, the benefit you would have had of having the house building and the houses, the improved housing in West Belfast, with all that would have generated. There would have been social as well as economic benefit. Now, that would not nearly have been as glamorous as a car that ends up in Back to the Future movie.
apparently it wasn't a very good car. I think in that famous scene in Back to the Future where he's going back to the future and he revs up, he can't get the car started and he revs it up and then it finally comes to life. That's overdubbed by some sort of American supercar. It was a very underpowered car, apparently.
The problem is every time I've written about DeLorean, there's a hardcore group of DeLorean fans out there who, it's quite funny, some of the descriptions of myself and some of their forums.
Right.
So-called professor is my favorite description. They're not very complimentary as soon as you comment on the car. Yeah, my understanding is the performance wasn't that great.
No.
Indeed, part of the reason why the DeLorean was eventually chosen to be the time machine in Back to the Future was in the original script, the Back to the Future script had knocked around Hollywood for years and years and years. And the time machine in earlier scripts had been
I think it was a fridge.
A bin lorry.
Or a bin lorry.
And a fridge.
Yeah.
And I believe I'm right in saying that inspired by, I think, the day the Earth stood still or Earth very flying saucers, like one of these two movies.
Right.
The Gullwing left an impression in the mind of one of the writers, and other people have commented that the DeLorean car is a 1950s vision of what the 1980s would look like. And I think if you think about the design of the DeLorean in that regard, again, I'm veering far from economics here, perhaps culturally, that's one of the reasons why the DeLorean had such resonance. Like, people talk about it. So if I say about Bricklin, you know, so I talk about the Bricklin was a very similar Gullwing car that was made in Canada, Newfoundland,
right.
And it died a death commercially in the mid-70s. But nobody's heard of the Bricklin.
Yeah, no, it's the movie.
The DeLorean, on the other hand, of course, people have. Indeed, John DeLorean actually wrote a letter to Robert Zemeckis, I think it was, thanking him for the profile that the movie gave to the product.
And yeah.
I know that there are people who will argue, and I would suggest they're right, that without Back to the Future, the cultural resonance of the DeLorean would not be any greater than the Bricklin.
So maybe if we go back to the economics before wrapping up, and think a bit about the recent development of the Northern Irish economy. We're in a post-1998 Good Friday Agreement era. Things are a bit more settled politically. The global economy seems to be switching to one that is service-led. Would you see the Northern Irish economy reflecting that global trend, or do you see it developing in a different way?
No, I think Northern Ireland certainly experienced deindustrialisation and certainly has transformed into a overwhelmingly service-based economy. The issue about Northern Ireland as a service-based economy is certainly it has a lot of high-value added consultancy-type jobs at the high end. But the thing to note is a lot of the high-end, high-value jobs are located disproportionately in Greater Belfast, indeed Belfast itself. That's the first thing to note. Second thing to note is that it is a service-based economy with a very large public sector as a share of the economy. And that actually, if we think about, I think people at the Nevin Institute a couple of years ago wrote a paper looking at the spatial economics of the island of Ireland as a whole, and they made an argument that actually there were three regional economies on the island. There was essentially a Greater Dublin economy, the rest of the south, as it were, then Northern Ireland. I would actually think, if you look at a lot of the numbers, you could argue there's four regional economies. The Greater Belfast economy is just like the Greater Dublin economy, a very different animal than the rest of the jurisdiction. And I think that since the Good Friday Agreement, certainly unemployment has come down, employment has gone up. But productivity has continued to lag. You know, I think people like John Fitzgerald and Edgar Morgenroth have been recently writing about this phenomena. And it is true, since the Good Friday Agreement, I think it's fair to say that, yes, there have been improvements been made in Northern Ireland, but it remains the case that Northern Ireland relies a lot on fiscal transfers from GB. And that this, in my the way I would present the case, this, the so-called subvention or fiscal transfer, as it's more recently been called, net fiscal balance, is the mirror image of the low productivity. Because the low productivity means that jobs aren't being created, so tax revenue hasn't been paid. And of course, that means that the public spending is ploughed into Northern Ireland, but the tax revenue is not generated in Northern Ireland, so there's a gap. Whatever you think the gap, the appropriate way to measure that gap is another question. But, you know, I think a gap that's substantial and actually as a share of the region's economy has actually grown over time is a problem, is arguably a problem of the economy. But it's more particularly the composition of the public spending, because I think there is a literature, like people like Danny Roderick and whatnot, who've elsewhere written about why different forms of public spending have very different repercussions for economic competitiveness. In Northern Ireland's case, it is highly open as a region, but a lot of the money that's ploughed into the Northern Irish economy from public spending has been simply to stabilise and redistribute rather than to generate a more competitive economy. So I think, what is it, the figure in terms of public spending? Oh, it's some very large figure. I think it's like expenditure per head in total. In 2016, the figure was something like 121 relative to UK index of 100. But that covers a massive variation, where something like recreation and culture, the index is like 219 compared to UK, whereas environmental protection is only 84. So, I mean, if you think about, you know, so there's a massive variation in not just the level of public spending in Northern Ireland relative to GB and the service-based economy, but it's also the composition. I'm very much an economist who thinks composition is key. I think a lot of problems.
Going forward then, how would you see the Northern Irish economy developing? We're in the middle of a COVID-19 crisis, but we cannot forget that other political issues such as Brexit, which may present hurdles or opportunities. Where would you see the important issues arising? How would you see the Northern Irish economy developing in the immediate future?
I think for Northern Ireland, as we've alluded to throughout the discussion, let's think about, you know, creative destruction. The real manifestation of that failure or lack of success is the productivity gap. Okay, now Northern Ireland hasn't closed that productivity gap on GB. And of course, as Nick Crafts has pointed out, it's not as if GB has been particularly clever in terms of productivity over the very long run. So Northern Ireland's failure to close the productivity gap with GB looks all the worse for the fact it's not closing it on a national economy that it hasn't particularly performed particularly well. So I think productivity is the main Achilles heel. What are the potentials? Well, the potentials are, I think, a lot of things that are important are, as often the case in economics, the things that are important in economics are often very imprecise. And the things that are very unimportant in economics are often very precise. And I think economists often focus on things that are precise because they're the paper. Those are things that get you in the American Economic Review. But the problem is those things may not be very important. They might be precise. So I think that the things that are going to make your economy wealthier are going to be things like productivity. Now, I think things like managerial quality matters a lot. I'm very convinced by the sort of Van Rennen and Bloom line of argument in general that that the quality of management does matter. So, you know, why does foreign direct investment on average on the planet have greater efficiency than indigenous firms? Well, because they're not enculturated into bad management techniques. They have a corporate view regardless where you are on planet Earth. So I think that foreign direct investment at its best is associated with better management and technology. So foreign direct investment, certainly. When you think about the other evidence, it does suggest that family firms underperform on average. Why? Well, because, of course, the nature of family firms on average means that people who aren't very capable but are, well, incredibly well-connected, i.e. their children of the owners of the firm, are going to become the managers in the firm. And that can lead to all sorts of problems in terms of retaining talent, etc. So I think, you know, so there's issues about management that needs to be tackled in terms of improving productivity. I think the stuff that John Fitzgerald and Edgar Muldergrath have said about education more generally, I would agree with, although I think that we should be very careful about how we interpret what we mean by improvements in human capital. I think it's very easy to become obsessed with league tables of exam results. And I'm not convinced that those are a good way to measure value added in education. I think they're far too easily gamed. So I'd say there's education, management, those are two areas. Improvements of infrastructure. You know, there's plenty of examples of how infrastructure in Northern Ireland could be improved. I think a general recognition that Northern Ireland or Ulster in the late 19th century, you know, in the late 19th century, Ulster was the fastest growing region of Ireland, and Ireland was the fastest growing component part of the United Kingdom. So in many ways, Ulster, late 19th century, as things were going wrong during the Second Industrial Revolution, we still shouldn't get away from the fact that despite that, it performed pretty well, all things considered, in that era of globalisation. And I think that as we look at the future of the world economy, it's not as if that we shouldn't be outward looking, and that there's a whole range of possibilities about green technologies, ageing populations, migration flows within Asia. There's a whole range of possibilities out there that I think a lot of firms in Northern Ireland could benefit from. But I think that's very much more about being export orientated and being innovative and entrepreneurial. I don't believe that the future is simply sucking in foreign direct investment, no questions asked. I'm far more convinced by people like Moretti, who, like in New Geography of Jobs, talks about raising skills levels and the ecology of skills within regions. I think those things all offer possibilities for improving the Northern Irish economy. But I think the general lesson will be, you know, again, as an economic historian, one thing you realise is if a problem takes a long time to emerge and persists for a long time, it's unlikely it can be solved very quickly. So problems like the UK economy, UK underperformance over the very long run, cannot even be rectified. You know, either the Labour government in the 60s through national planning and the Thatcher government in the 80s with monetarism both found it very difficult to turn around the juggernaut. And I think as an economic historian, that would be a general lesson, a cautionary note. I hope that's not too downbeat an ending, but that's it.
No, thank you very much, Graham. It was very, very interesting. So thank you very much.
Glad you enjoyed it.
So my thanks to Graham. I learned a lot about the Northern Irish economy, and I found it quite fascinating. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share with friends and colleagues. A 5-star review on iTunes will be particularly helpful in getting the listeners on board. So thank you and all the best.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.